Judiciary to order. I have a brief statement I want to make before we actually start the process. We will be hearing House Bill 2020 today. This bill deals with an emotional subject that involves principal positions that are different for many people. It is my desire to have a hearing process that respects the differences of opinion of the parties in regard to this bill. I know I can expect my committee members to be professional and respectful. I expect the same of those for you in the audience. We will be having invited testimony with the bill's presentation by Speaker Minnis, testimony and comments by both Republican and Democratic House and Senate members, pro and con panels that have been selected and have been brought forward, and we will have public testimony for 45 minutes with about a 3-minute limit, trying to accommodate as many people as we can. If you are going to be in hearing room C, the overflow room, and you do want to testify during the public testimony, you'll have to come in and sign up here. If you have written testimony, please give the copies to the clerk so we'll have those to take a look at. Mr. Taylor, do you have a few comments there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do have, you just passed out the two written documents, one from Paul Abrams, professor at law at Lewis and Clark Law School, testimony in opposition to 2020, and one from the Oregon Catholic Conference, in which I understand that we will be getting amendments to this bill later. I understand that one of the amendments would remove the death penalty from the bill. I have not seen the amendments. And I understand from Mr. Castagna, the Oregon Catholic Conference has supported the bill if it's amended to remove the death penalty. And I also, if anyone has written testimony that they'd like to submit and do not plan to testify and want to submit it for the record, they can do so by giving it to the clerks and we'll put it into the record for them.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll be opening our public hearing on House Bill 2020. Speaker Minnis and Mr. Grabowski.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning.
This weekend I had the delight to go with my daughter-in-law, who is expecting our first grandchild in June. And we have since, as you know, on opening day, received word that our second daughter-in-law is going to have a baby in September. It set the stage and brings home House Bill 2020. It makes it even more real than it was before. When a woman expects to have a child and wants that child and is rejoicing in anticipation of the birth of their child, there should be every expectation that that child should be born unhindered, unharmed, and without any harm inflicted on that child. This bill is straightforward. It's simple. It says that when a child is wanted, when the woman that is carrying that baby and anticipates and wants to have that baby born, that there should be an avenue of justice when harm is brought to both the woman and the child. House Bill 2020 sets forth in law the recognition that the child is a wanted child, and that child deserves to live, and if that child is harmed, that there needs to be justice set in motion. I appreciate the committee's consideration of this bill this morning. I'm going to keep my comments very brief. Mr. Gransky is the father of Lacey Peterson, who came up today because he feels this bill is so important, and is going to be talking to you today about the importance of having a piece of legislation today.
Mr. Gransky, would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Ronald Frank Gransky.
And tell us your story, please.
If you don't know, 2 years and 3 months ago, December 24th, Lacey Rocha Peterson, my stepdaughter, was reported missing, and throughout the last 2.5 years, our family's been living in hell. She was murdered, thrown into the ocean. Where on April 13th, our grandson washed up on the beach. On April 14th, which was Easter, or around Easter time, Lacey's body washed up. You're, I'm sure, all parents, or you will be parents, you have grandkids. You might not realize it when you're young, having your children growing up, trying to make a living and take care of them, keep a roof over their heads. But I know you know when you're grandparents. That pregnant woman is carrying your grandson or granddaughter. It's not a fetus. It's your grandson or granddaughter. Somebody kills your daughter or that baby, they need to be punished for that. Plain and simple. It has nothing to do with abortion, has nothing to do, I am pro-choice, has nothing to do with that. Just plain simple. I build shopping centers for a living. I always saw on TV, never going to happen to us. Glad it's not me. Trust me, it can be you. And when you see that person brought into a courtroom, and you know that not only did they take your daughter, but they took your grandchild. You've got to have justice for both, not for one. It makes it hard in our case because Brent, Lacey's brother, his wife, Rose, was pregnant at the same time Lacey was. Massey was born April 10th of that. Connor was due February 10th. Connor's body was found April 13th. Lacey's body April 14th. Dates will always be important in our lives, and we will always fight for this type of a bill. It's important. It's just basic. I brought a card. I'd like to read just a few couple paragraphs, if I may. We probably get, I think we're close to 2 million emails now that we've throughout the country and the world. And we have one room that people have sent things to us, little angels and pictures and hundreds of thousands of cards. And Sharon and I go through every one. It's going to take a while. I want to read you just two paragraphs of this. This is from a man named Jeff. I can't pretend to know Lacey, but if I may, she seemed like a girl who celebrated life's events, big and small, in a very genuine and infectious way. The warmth of her personality glows from each photo, and it's impossible not to smile back at her image. My hope is that now you and all may be able to begin to celebrate Lacey and Connor, as life's tragically cut so very short, and as life not given an opportunity to begin. In my heart, I want to think Lacey's all too brief life was nonetheless a full one, and even though at this moment I can't begin to find anything positive about any of this, I want to try to think that somehow, some way, someday, there may be something good that comes from this. This is what the good can come from this. This is from a man from Portland, Oregon. Not a woman, a man from Portland, Oregon. And I didn't ask his permission, so I'm not going to give you his last name or address. But, this is important. And hopefully I've helped Speaker Minnis to get this across. Thank you.
Committee members, do you have any questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm going to bring up the next panel, Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Nolan, and is Senator Brown here?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from House District 42, and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on this very serious situation this morning. I appreciate the committee's attention to the serious problem of violence against women. As a former co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, I have worked for many years to develop understanding of the issues that affect women's health and find solutions to improve the health status of the women of Oregon. National and Oregon data alike demonstrate that violence against women is the source of significant health risks for women, and that violence against women by an intimate partner, spouses, and boyfriends is a major public health problem. The risk of injury from intimate partner violence is present in every social, economic, religious, and cultural group, and is three times higher for women than for men. You'll find attached to my testimony reports from our own state public health officials regarding the extent of the problem of intimate partner violence in our state, and in particular, information about homicides against women. I note for you that although you are here considering criminal penalties for crimes of violence, our state study shows that most violence against women is not dealt with at all in the criminal justice system. I also wanted to mention that I have met with the parents of Carrie Rep, who is another case similar to the Lacey Peterson case that happened here in Oregon, and so have learned by talking to them just how devastating these situations are, although none of us could ever understand what parents are going through when they lose a child, a daughter in this situation. I am coming to understand, I think, and have a little insight into what that must be like for them. Providing appropriate police response, emergency care, and safe harbor for women who are victims of violence is an ongoing struggle in Oregon, as it is elsewhere in the United States. Efforts in the last few legislative sessions to address the problem have only served to highlight how inadequate our response has been. As we meet here today, there are women, pregnant women, women with children who are living in violent environments and who are struggling to survive because they have escaped from violent environments but do not have the wherewithal yet to care for themselves. This is one reason that I come to express grave reservations about the bill you are considering today. All of us wish to protect women from violence. All of us want to assure that those who perpetrate such crimes are properly punished. However, I strongly suggest whether establishing specific and separate penalties in the law for harming a fetus will do anything to accomplish this goal. As our studies have shown, women who are victims of violence have for too long been in the shadows. I would suggest that the approach taken by House Bill 2020 once again focuses us away from the very real criminal intent to injure, maim, and murder a woman, in this case a pregnant woman, by focusing attention instead on an intended or even unintended effect on a developing fetus. This committee knows well that by focusing on the developing fetus and by placing a label, unborn child, with a broad definition at any stage of development, House Bill 2020 forces members to stake out positions on very difficult medical and ethical issues. These issues are some of the most divisive and partisan within this body. They cannot be resolved without one group imposing its religious and ethical beliefs on the other. This is a disappointing and unnecessary fight to bring to the body when there is a social concern that we all share, the health of women, pregnant and non-pregnant, that we could join together to address. I urge this committee in the strongest terms to consider solutions to the problems of assault and murder of pregnant women by focusing exactly on that, violence against pregnant women. I urge you to work with sponsors of this and other bills to begin again with a focus on how to send a strong message that violence against a pregnant woman is unacceptable in our state. If this committee moves too quickly to push this bill from committee and onto the floor, the only result will be a partisan and divisive fight that will ill serve the women we seek to protect. I therefore urge you to move with caution and to consider other alternatives. I would be happy to participate in continued dialogue on this question, and I also would be happy to take any questions you may have. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again very much for the opportunity to testify on this very significant issue.
Representative Rosenbaum, it appears in from recent 2 or 3 years there's an increase, an open increase. Maybe it's because the news media is, you know, concentrated on more, that there is more violence on pregnant women. If you had to pick out one thing that you think might be contributing to that increase, what would it be?
Well, that's a very, thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. It's a very difficult question to answer and to isolate one factor. I mean, certainly one factor that we would have to consider would be the state of the economy, the high unemployment. I think, you know, that would be one thing that I would look at, particularly in our state when we've been so devastated in the last few years. But I really couldn't begin to isolate what would be the one single factor. I'm sure there are many.
Okay. Committee members, you have some questions or comments? Okay, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Nolan, and I have the privilege of representing Southwest Portland in the House of Representatives. And I come here on their behalf today, but I also come to speak to you today as a woman who enjoys the wonder of motherhood because of the miracle of adoption. My family was formed through adoption, and I know from very personal experience the joys that that opportunity brings to a family, and it is that experience that really motivates my testimony today. When considering any legislation, we owe it to Oregonians to consider three basic questions. Indeed, we owe it to Oregonians to be able to declare an unequivocal yes in answer to each of these questions before we move legislation forward. I appreciate the opportunity to address House Bill 2020 and those fundamental questions. I would submit for your consideration that any legislation you consider should not gain your support unless you are thoroughly convinced that it satisfies these three questions. First, does the proposed measure effectively achieve its goal or goals? Second, is the proposed measure the most efficient way of achieving this goal or these goals? And third, is the proposed measure written so as to avoid all harmful side effects? I'd like to walk quickly through these questions in some detail because I think an honest, objective review will lead to the conclusion that House Bill 2020 does not give us a yes answer to any of them. And when I conclude, I'd like to encourage this committee and the sponsors of this bill to work with a larger community so that we can develop legislation that does. First, does the proposed measure effectively achieve its goal or goals? We've heard from the bill's sponsors, read in the newspapers, and been able to surmise from the bill itself that House Bill 2020 aims to protect pregnant women from injury and death so that they may choose for themselves how to complete their pregnancies, whether their choice is to continue the pregnancies and deliver healthy, well-adjusted children, or to end the pregnancies and have medically safe abortions. Protecting these women is indeed a noble pursuit, and one that should enjoy widespread, even universal support. I grieve for the women who have suffered violence during their pregnancies. I cry for their families because they've been traumatized. My prayers have gone out and go out to Lacey Peterson and Carrie Rep, to every other woman who has been abused or killed, and to their families. But because House Bill 2020 ignores what most often threatens pregnant women, their health and their children, it misses its goal. The changes to our criminal law that House Bill 2020 proposes speak exclusively to the status of the unborn child, almost as if the woman herself were unnecessary. It seems to rely entirely on a deterrent effect of a penalty that has proven not to be a deterrent. Second question. Is the proposed measure the most efficient way of achieving this goal or these goals? You'll hear more from other professionals who dedicate their lives to caring for women and children about the pervasive threats to women, especially pregnant women. So I'm not going to sit here and pretend to be either a medical expert or a social worker. It is hard, maybe even impossible, for most of us to imagine what could ever provoke one person to do violence against another person. How much more difficult is it then for us to imagine how a husband could come to hurt or kill his wife, the mother of his child? Yet if we cannot bring ourselves to understand the minds and hearts of the women, men, and families in these tragic circumstances, then we can't begin to offer valid solutions to help them. What we do know and what we should focus on are the factors that most often pose real chronic threats to the health and well-being of pregnant women and their children. Physical and sexual abuse, often begun before the pregnancy and often accelerated during, perhaps because of, the pregnancy. Lack of affordable family planning services close enough to these women's homes so that it can be useful to the women, helping them plan and space their children's births to assure the woman's capacity to properly and lovingly care for all her children. Lack of prenatal care, nutrition training, and parenting skills for new mothers-to-be and fathers-to-be. Lack of treatment programs for alcohol and drug addictions. Lack of mental health care for women and children, whether that lack is because they don't have any insurance or because the insurance they have through private coverage excludes mental health services. An economic and cultural dependence that force women, often with their children, to stay in abusive relationships. Most Oregonians willingly support a goal of protecting pregnant women so they can choose to deliver healthy babies. We owe it to them to promote policies and services that have been proven effective at helping women, because it's the best way to respect the women involved, and because it's the way to get the best results for the taxpayers' dollars. Since House Bill 2020 does not address any of these important causes of poor health in both women and their children, it would be a woefully expensive experiment that likely would lead to less safety for pregnant women and their families, and a great deal of wasted opportunity and money. But of course, this bill is not really about money. It's about how we recognize and protect the dignity of women Indeed, if this bill were to become law, we should expect to see many of these conditions worsen for too many Oregon women and children. Finally, is the proposed measure written so as to avoid all harmful side effects? You will hear from others today who are better qualified to speak to the medical and legal problems that House Bill 2020 presents. I urge you to absorb their good counsel before you take any action on this bill. I will address one deeply troubling, harmful side effect that we should all work together to avoid. Specifically, there are real women, children, families, communities who have already suffered unspeakable tragedy because of violence against pregnant women. We cannot undo that hurt. We cannot bring back the fallen. But we can, and we must, honor their lives by finding a solution that brings us together rather than splitting us further apart. A solution that strengthens our sense of community rather than makes us suspicious of each other. We should not cheapen the pain of these grieving families by trying to score political points, by pushing bills that pointedly carry names from only one political party. It makes everyone involved look small. It makes the legislature as a whole look small. It is beneath us. The people who sent each of us here from our districts, who pay our salaries, deserve a better effort than that and a better outcome than just a standoff. On behalf of the Pro-Choice Caucus, I would gladly offer to work with members of this committee and with the sponsors of this bill to wipe the slate clean, start from scratch, in writing a bill that garners broad support and delivers real and immediate help to vulnerable pregnant women and their families. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address your committee.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nolan. Page 2 of your comments when you were addressing your second point of your three questions, you list concerns about health care and affordable family planning and prenatal care, alcohol and drug, mental care. I'm unclear as to how those things, while I agree with you, those are issues that we need to address, and they are very important in the overall care of women and pregnant women, how those things address the real issue of whether a crime has been perpetrated upon not only a woman, but a woman who may be pregnant and that child.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores. As I understand the purpose of this bill, it is to protect women, pregnant women, from harm to themselves and their unborn children. What I am suggesting is that this bill, as it's currently proposed, not only fails to achieve that goal, but it distracts attention from the services that we as a legislature can provide that we know achieve that goal of protecting pregnant women. And the items that I listed that you mentioned are the most important services that we could provide that would, in fact, protect these women much more effectively than adding to the criminal code.
Follow up. And once again, I agree with you in the list that you gave and your response that these are very important issues to women, and especially if they are pregnant. However, the purpose of the bill is to address when a crime has been committed. a murder of a woman who is carrying an unborn child. So I'm failing to see that these health issues addressing a woman who is alive reach the goal of the bill, which is to find a suitable punishment when a crime has been of murder has been committed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, thank you for the clarification. Within the context of the criminal code, the purpose for criminal sanctions is to deter the behavior so that people do not suffer that violence or that behavior. And I have submitted that this bill does not achieve that, and that if that's what we want to do, if what we want to do is deter harm to pregnant women and their unborn children, then we should pursue other ways that will in fact result in those good goals. But this bill doesn't.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nolan, thanks for your testimony. I just have two questions, though. First one is, in light of what House Bill 2020 does, do you see a distinction between criminal act versus what the law allows through choice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Is there a clear defined line between that of what the law allows for choice, as you described abortion earlier in your testimony, with that of taking a life through a criminal act?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I'm not a lawyer, and I would not want to interpret the law other than to understand it as lawyers advise me.
Okay. Thank you. Then, referring to your second page of your notes, of your, you mentioned, indeed, if this bill were to become law, we should expect to see many of these conditions worsen for too many Oregon women and children. Do you have factual evidence that supports that statement?
Representative Olson, I don't have factual information about that. What I do have is the experience of people who serve pregnant women and families at risk, and their assessment, which I think you'll hear about later, and I am not the best person to give you all the details, but what we do know is that families at risk, families in dire situations, suffer accelerated or expanded damage when we throw divisive responses into their situation, when we add to the stress of an already stressful situation.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Representatives Anderson, Nelson, and Farr, please.
For the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson of House District Number 3 in Southern Oregon. I'm here in support of House Bill 2020 for several reasons. When a death occurs in a family, the whole family and all their friends grieve. This week we were reminded of this by the passing of Representative Jerry Crummell's mother. Several years ago, Carrie Rupp of Central Point was shot to death. She was expecting a child at that time, and the baby also died as a result of her death. Although she believed in the right to abortion, Carrie chose to carry her baby to term, but her choice was taken from her by a sadistic person who despised her life and the life of her child. Were she to be here, according to her parents, she wanted to have her baby and to see that baby come to full life. Carrie had shown stellar character and gone through much stress as she felt life developing within her body. Her parents can tell of her zest for life and her desire for the future. That life and the baby's life were gunned down inhumanely short of full term. But just as we heard from Mr. Gransky, two bodies were involved. Two bodies were carefully recovered from San Francisco Bay, Lacey and Connor Peterson. But there were two bodies involved in Central Point, too, Carrie Rep and Baby Rep. 2 years after the shooting, the tiny form of Carrie's baby was lovingly cremated, with much emotion again for the parents, Ron and Joanne Johnson. Again, they had to bear the grief of losing a much-anticipated new grandchild, as well as a much-loved daughter. Not one death, but two separate deaths. 29 states carry a penalty for such a heinous crime. 29 states ascribe a penalty for killing not just a pregnant mother-to-be, but also her baby. 29 other states say the fetus is a human being. They understand that if a mother should live in a murder attempt and the baby died, there is a death. Another person has died. There's a bill in the Senate that would only add severity to the death of the mother if her baby is killed also. If there was not another death, then why would we even be considering increasing the penalty for killing the mother? Our laws don't allow a person to be punished for killing something that has no life. There is no murder charge for killing a dead person. If the baby is not a living human being, it's ludicrous to add another penalty. It's time for Oregon and every other state to provide a penalty for a killer when he murders a pregnant woman and her baby. This is the supreme protection against domestic violence, to protect an expectant mother. Federal law says that if a mother is murdered within a federal jurisdiction and both she and her baby die, there are penalties for both deaths. In Oregon, at this time, only one death can be recognized. In the dangerous time in which we live, that must change. A killer must recognize that if he snuffs out the life of a human being, even within the womb, he will pay dearly. Even if he does not kill the mother, when he snuffs out the life of a growing human fetus, he is destroying another human being. We all remember the pregnant woman in Oregon City several years ago who survived a murder attempt, but her baby died. In Oregon then, that crime was not a murder. If not, what was it? Common sense dictates that a life was taken. The public wants pregnant women and their babies protected. Life is too precious to devalue it for any human being. Civilized human society all through history has respected the dignity of mothers, whether in Judeo-Christian law or Islamic law or every other society. There's been a sanctity surrounding a mother who looks forward to the life springing from her womb. It's time in this 21st century, as we learn more of the marvels of the human body, to ascribe value to the life that a mother-to-be carries. If a criminal, a murderer, is unwilling to dignify a mother's choice to carry a baby to term as it lives and grows in her body, if a murderer is unwilling to give parents and grandparents and brothers and sisters and family and friends the joy of witnessing a new life into this world, then it's time for us in this legislature to provide a due penalty for his taking that life. I urge you to pass House Bill 2020 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and send it on to the Senate and the Governor to be placed into the law of this state and allow and align our laws with the law of the land. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Representative Nolan earlier. In light of House Bill 2020, do you feel that there's a distinction between criminal act versus what the law allows through choice?
Yes, I do. I do feel that a criminal act... let me clarify what you mean by choice in this situation.
Choice being, you know, the right for the mother herself to choose whether or not she wants to abort the child.
We have excluded that choice from this law. There is total freedom for a mother if she, by any act that she commits, causes the death of a baby, or if she chooses to abort the baby, she has that right. I do think there's a difference when someone else comes and takes the life of that baby, that okay. human being.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Nelson, would you like to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Krieger and members of this committee, I'm Donna Nelson, State Representative from District 24. I've also been a mother of 8 assorted children, stepchildren, adopted children, natural birth children, and foster children. Also the grandmother of 3 and a surrogate grandmother to a baby that survived, one that was born weighing 1 pound, 4 ounces and is today a healthy 10-year-old. I would like to say that the time is now. Psychopathic murderers must be held accountable for their violent actions against all persons, born and unborn. By passing House Bill 2020, which expands criminal homicide to include the cause of death to an unborn child, we join 15 other states which now have fetal homicide laws whereby fetuses are victims at any stage of development. Oregon must do the same. All persons, born and unborn, are equal in rights and value. And we restore those precious rights by doing what is right in the eyes of God and a moral, caring society. In 2001, Dr. Diana Ching, Director of Women's Health at the Maryland Department of Health and Medical Hygiene, and Dr. Isabel Horan conducted a 5-year study in Maryland to determine the leading cause of death among pregnant women aged 14 to 44. Of the 247 women who died while pregnant, homicide was found to be the leading cause of death, accounting for 20% of the cases. These findings were reported in the March 21, 2001 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Pregnancy is now being seen as an aggravating factor that increases a woman's risk of being murdered. Pregnancy is obviously a big, life-changing event, especially for men. The emotional and financial responsibilities involved are huge stones around their necks. 42% of murdered women are killed by their intimate partners. The recent passage of Lacey and Connor's bill in California, making it a federal capital offense to murder a fetus, sends us a clear message. Men who cross the line to murder their pregnant wives or girlfriends show signs of being psychopathic long before the murder, according to Pat Brown, a criminal profiler and president of the Sexual Homicide Exchange. From the moment of conception, every human being has worth. No one should have the right to end the life of another, even a person in the womb. God alone has the right to determine the boundaries of our lives, including the end. The eternal spirit that begins at conception with a detectable heartbeat 18 days thereafter and with signals from the fetal brain detectable after 6 weeks is that of an innocent child, a human being. a heartbeat, and a brain. The precious life of that tiny baby should not be ended by the immoral, despicable violence of a deranged murderer who is held unaccountable. An unborn child is viable as against any assailant, because if left in its mother's consensual care, it would probably continue to survive. An analogy can be made to a man who shoots at a woman lying in her bed, but whose bullet kills not only the woman, but also a concealed child underneath the woman's blanket. The shooter did not know about the child when he aimed his gun, but his actions were nonetheless intentional, and he specifically meant for those actions to result in a person's death. He would probably be found guilty of murder for both deaths. This concession logically amounts to an acknowledgement that intent with respect to one murder victim can be understood to extend to all victims killed by the same deliberately homicidal action that was directed against one of the victims, even if the presence or existence of other victims was unknown to the killer. I can identify with that statement. 10 years ago, my son-in-law, Fred, made a decision. In a situation where he conceived that life was no longer worth living, he went to the bedroom where my youngest granddaughter, or my only granddaughter at that time, had crawled in bed with her mother. My daughter abruptly awoke as she'd gotten up early to pick him up from the airport. And she was very tired, and she immediately asked what was going on. And at that moment, in the blink of an eyelid, life changed and life prevailed for my daughter and my granddaughter, Victory. Moments later, Fred placed the gun to his heart and left this world. Now, my question today is, how important is it that the human being be visible? Would that be a deterrent to an individual committing murder? Is it murder if a shot goes into a home, killing an individual inside that home who was unseen by the killer? Yes, we've had that happen in our backyard. Would Scott Peterson have stopped his horrendous crime had he seen Connor? An unborn child has moral worth that requires that as long as the mother is prepared to sustain the physical and emotional burdens of pregnancy, others must refrain from harming her unborn child. The murder of a pregnant woman is the direct product of intentionally homicidal behavior. The death of an unborn child has the same legal import as the death of any living human being. Our previous representatives who testified spoke to the unspeakable tragedy of individuals like Lacey and Connor. Well, that is a tragedy that shouldn't be unspeakable. It should be one we're speaking about and doing something about. One representative spoke and said she had no desire to cheapen the pain. Well, let me assure you, I wasn't
quite as deeply impacted as perhaps Lacey and Connor, but there is no way you can cheapen the pain of losing a child or an unborn baby. I'm amazed today that in the materials we were previously handed by the other representatives, that there was no data regarding pregnant mothers. We talked about crimes by intimate partners, but why weren't there statistics about pregnant mothers? An unborn child is an unborn child is an unborn child. The only partisan issue that House Bill 2020 should bring about is that we are partisan on behalf of that pregnant mother and that unborn child. I urge you to pass House Bill 2020.
Any members have any comments or questions? Thank you, Donna. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. My name is Debbie Farr. I'm State Representative for House District 14. Chair Krieger and members of the committee, I probably have the shortest testimony this morning, but as a mother of a young daughter and two sons, I can tell you that if my daughter, while carrying a child, or my future daughter-in-laws while carrying a child were killed, I would consider the loss of that young woman as well as the child that she carried, my grandchild. In watching Lacey Peterson's mother on television talk about the loss of her daughter and her grandchild, I identified with her pain because she talked about Connor, the grandchild that she would never hold. And you could see the pain of loss, not only for her daughter Lacey, but also for her grandson. I think that what we have to view this as is validation that you have lost not just one family member, but two. I polled a number of my friends, those who believe that abortion is a choice and those who believe that it is not a choice, and uniformly, all being women about my age and future grandmothers, they said that they would want to know, they would want the world to tell them that they had not just lost a daughter, but they had also lost a grandchild. I urge you to pass House Bill 2020 to the floor. Thank you.
Committee members, any questions? Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a question to the panel. I know that the strength of your convictions is profound and sincere, and we all feel that here today, regardless of our positions on the merits of this bill. But in view of your convictions and in view of the broad scope of this bill, which involves the classification of new crimes, new incarceration costs, prosecution costs, defense costs, how come it is that this bill that you believe in so sincerely does not come to us with a fiscal impact statement or a cost to the state of the new revenues which would be needed? And without that, aren't you really offering us an unfunded mandate?
I guess I would believe, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think life, and when you take life, is above cost. There are many costs in our judicial system that are involved from the past and carrying on to today. And I think it's so ultimately important that we respect life in the womb as we do the life of the mother, that a small cost, were that to be the case, is well worth the cost.
Representative Ackerman, you're a lawyer, and you are well aware that we have this statement, justice for all, and that does include an unborn child. I'd also like to say that safety has to be our top priority in society. And if it is an unfunded mandate, which I don't believe it is, I believe it's an extension of actions that are currently occurring, perhaps that we're not prosecuting to the fullest, that this is already part of our law. This is just an extension of one.
Representative Ackerman, Chair Krieger, I would be curious to know, what is the current cost for a double homicide? If a young woman were walking down the street and she were carrying an infant in a front pack on her chest, and then that killer were convicted of two murders, what would be the cost versus whether or not she was walking alone?
If that's a question, may I answer that? I think under normal circumstances, a bill of this nature, when it creates new classifications of crime, and this is coming from experience in sitting on this committee for now my third session, that involves additional incarceration costs, additional prosecution costs, additional defense costs. And considering the wide scope of this bill, I think these costs could be quite profound. We do know from the record in this case that the speaker did not make a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I'm just wondering if that is so, and that is her power and her prerogative. How do we possibly come to any estimate of what the costs are and how they would be borne? Under normal circumstances, we could get those estimates from fiscal or for the Criminal Justice Commission, but since there's no subsequent referral to Ways and Means, we are denied the benefit of those cost reports.
Representative Ackerman, Mr. Chair, will you address why that's not...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the staff of Judiciary Committee works closely with the staff of Ways and Means Committee, particularly as it relates to fiscal impact statements. And what we try to do is, because of the heavy workload that they have in getting fiscal impact statements to them, we try to give them a heads up when, if a bill is going to go to work session. That's the normal time that we have to have a fiscal impact statement here, and that's at work session. I understood this morning that it was not going to work session, that we have amendments. There are amendments coming to the bill. I have not seen them. I have been told, as I mentioned earlier, that they will remove the death penalty. My assumption is that will reduce the cost. I went down this morning, and I talked to John Board, and I said it does not look like the bill is going out today. You don't need a fiscal impact statement for this meeting. When we go to work session, we'll obviously need it. I also told him as soon as I get a copy of the amendments, I would get him a copy of the amendments so he could also address the amendments.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to have the next panel come up, Mark Balkamp, Balkman, Andrea Meyer, and Kelly Skye.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's Blackman.
Just Blackman.
Like the
it's
color.
Spelled wrong on here. Yeah. Thank you.
I want to thank you for making this opportunity available to me. I want you to know that I'm here today to oppose House Bill 2020, not because of what it might or might not mean about a woman's right to choose, whether it would or would not pass state or federal constitutional muster, or whether it will or will not cost an awful lot of money, all of which I think the state's going to pay. I'm here today opposing the bill as a former federal prosecutor, as a former criminal law professor, as a recurring member of law committees to improve the law that have been organized by various associations and courts, and as a current person in private practice who represents both the victims of crimes and those accused of crime, to oppose it because I believe this bill conflicts with the fundamental legislative policy of this state when it comes to the enforcement of the criminal law, because I believe it will not advance the interests of its very sponsors, and because I think it would really much more likely undermine those very interests. I have prepared written testimony, which is being submitted to the committee. This will be an abbreviated version of that. House Bill 2020 conflicts with the fundamental legislative policy of the state regarding the purpose of the criminal law. The legislature in ORS 161-0952 specifically provides that with exceptions outside the criminal code and with exceptions for what we call violations, which are to say offenses that do not carry sanctions beyond monetary penalties, a person is not guilty of an offense unless he acts with a culpable mental state with respect to each material element of the offense that necessarily requires a culpable mental state. The only exception is, as I say, for those minor offenses that we call violations, like speeding. House Bill 2020 departs from, and indeed it does violence to that fundamental principle of and legislative policy. By dispensing with any culpable mental state requirement, the bill fails to give fair warning of the nature of the conduct declared to be an offense, and it creates liability without fault, rendering knowledge and intent irrelevant, undermines the fundamental deterrent influence of the criminal law because a person's decisions and behavior cannot be affected when consequences have no relationship to knowledge and intent. House Bill 2020 should be rejected because it constitutes a fundamental departure from the legislative policy that this state enacted 30 years ago and has embraced consistently since that time. I also oppose the bill because it will not advance the interests of the sponsors. Would it really advance the interests that we have just heard expressed in very moving terms? The answer is no. The sanctity of life, however you choose to define it, is diminished. It's not elevated when you declare the knowledge of life irrelevant. If I'm just as bad a person for causing an unintended consequence as I am for an intended one, then the focus is on me, not on the consequence. And by eliminating these kinds of culpability and intent and knowledge requirements, what House Bill 2020 does is it makes the existence of life as its sponsors define it a mere circumstance. It diminishes the sanctity of life. Okay. Finally, by making this a strict liability offense, House Bill 2020 really will undermine the interests that it proposes to advance. As a prosecutor and to some extent a criminal defense lawyer, I will tell you that jurors bring, just as I mean the members of this committee bring, a fundamental sense of right and wrong to the courtroom. There was an op-ed piece by David Reinhart in yesterday's Oregonian, some of you may have seen, where he brings that same fundamental sense to the column, where he talks about this act declaring what any woman who said we're having a baby or any man who's gazed in awe at an ultrasound knows. And what Mr. Reinhart, who's a sponsor or a proponent of this bill, I should say, what he's assuming is that we're talking about an act with knowledge. And what he's really saying, although it's not intended, I don't think, is that if this bill covers unknowing acts, it doesn't accomplish its purpose. And in my experience, both as a prosecutor and as a defense lawyer, when a jury is deprived of the judgment of fault, or when it is asked to hold someone accountable for a significant event without fault, in the absence of fault, it resists doing it. It is contrary to our instinct, our moral sense of right and wrong. And if you adopt a bill that makes liability independent of knowledge
juries are going to reject the responsibility. And how will that advance the goal of sanctifying life, however you choose to define it? It won't. So for all of those reasons, I urge this committee to reject House Bill 2020 and vote no. Thank you.
I have a question. Yeah, Mr. Blackman, you refer a couple different times in your notes regarding a culpable mental state. Could you advise us exactly what the definition of culpable mental state is?
Representative Wilson, the Oregon Criminal Code, which was the result of a very long-term study by very capable members of this body as well as others, adopted, I think it's ORS 161005, it may be somewhere else around there, which defines culpable mental state as requiring at least what is called criminal negligence or recklessness or knowledge or intent. Those are the four recognized culpable mental states. All of them require, and all of those are defined in terms of the ability to know or not know of the existence of a circumstance that reflects on the moral quality of the act.
Okay.
Chair?
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blackman, just pursuing that issue about whether the feature of this bill that would apply serious criminal sanctions to a person who causes a result without having any particular mental state, I noticed that the bill creates an exception for lawful abortions, but not for other medical procedures. Is it possible that someone who is providing medical therapy to a woman who happens to be pregnant without even knowing that that person is pregnant and thereby causes an end to the pregnancy could be prosecuted under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think the answer to that is clearly yes. And indeed, as I was reflecting, driving down here today about these remarks, it did occur to me that if you adopt this bill as written, then I think you're going to have to require pregnancy tests for any woman who suffers any injury at anyone's hands. Because you won't know whether or not the crime in subsection 8 has been committed unless you know that that woman was, in fact, at some stage of pregnancy, whether it's 2 days, 6 hours, 4 weeks. And, again, because it eliminates the requirement of knowledge or intent, it makes anyone who causes any damage to that fetus, unborn child, a criminal, a Class B, 10 years in prison, felon. That, to me, makes no sense. It's contrary to the policy of the state and just bad public policy on any level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Blackman. You refer, again, to the policies of the state, and I take it that you're referring to under number one of your discussion, items A through G, and you're calling that knowledge. And I'm concerned that you're drawing a distinction between knowledge and acknowledgement of the life that we're dealing with. Can you give me some clarification?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores. The first section, I apologize for the legalistic content of this written testimony, but I thought it was important to start at the fundamental principles. 161025, which is at page 1 and 2, that identifies the policy of the state, the purpose of the criminal law. But it is then implemented through, and this is on page 3, ORS 161095, which is the statute that requires a culpable mental state. Now, with respect to the acknowledgement question, there is no purpose served in using the criminal law to punish X for injury to Y if there was nothing that creates a link between the two. You are not acknowledging anything if you make someone strictly liable for a totally unintended consequence. you are, as I say in my written testimony, you are diminishing the value, because you are saying to some, you are saying, as the policy of the state is, it doesn't matter that you knew or didn't know, intended or didn't intend. You are liable. So it's just like a coincidence. Is that how we sanctify life, by making it a coincidence for the punishment of someone else? I don't think so. I think what you do is you provide the resources. Domestic violence, I've been a lawyer for 30 years, mostly involved in this kind of stuff. I mean, real human life events. And I will tell you, there's not more violence now than there was 25 years ago. We're just aware of it. And, you know, for about 10 years, about 10 years into my professional life, we were devoting resources to providing help to people. We don't do that anymore. The criminal justice system is now sort of our triage system, because we've cut money for social services, for family intervention. We are putting people at risk by spending money. I mean, turning this kind of unintended offense into an aggravated murder, you could pay for shelters for, I don't know, at least 24 women and their children for a year, for the $500,000 it costs to litigate a death penalty case in this state. So this is just a wrong-headed way of achieving a goal which everyone agrees to: protecting women and the unborn, the wanted unborn. It doesn't do it. And it actually diverts resources, which come out of the same general fund, from programs that do work, that did work when they existed. Sorry to get so much.
Thank you. A quick follow-up in regard to the discussion that you just gave. You indicate, and I think many of us have probably said, and I think perhaps it was expressed earlier, do we know about it more now, or is it more prevalent now, the abuse issue? Do you have statistics to back your assertion that it was the same 25 years ago as it is today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I didn't bring them. I can tell you that those studies, you see, it wasn't until this legislature really made things like a domestic violence assault a mandatory arrestable offense, or that you had a statute that we do now which says that if someone violates a protective order, the police must take that person into custody. That's the first time we had even a statistical base, or an experiential base from which we could draw statistics. When I was a young lawyer, well into my career, police would respond to a domestic violence situation and just say, hey, come on, cool it, and not intervene. And so you don't have the statistics, because it was viewed as a family matter. It was not viewed as violence against women. We've come a long way, but to say that having come a long way means that we should think that because we're paying attention now, the problem didn't exist before, is just, you know, using our own former ignorance to support a presumed conclusion. You just can't do it. And I think if you just ask beat cops, I mean, there's, you know, ask beat cops, how many domestic violence cases did they respond to 25 years ago? How many do they respond to today? I think they'll tell you it's about the same.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need some clarification for my own mental state here. What I'm hearing you say in relation to mental culpability is that, for instance, if a person, let's just hypothetically, shoots another person with the intent to kill them, the bullet penetrates the wall, shoots kills a sleeping child on the other side, that because the person didn't intend to shoot the person on the other side, that a jury would not find them culpable, or that's kind of what I'm getting from your testimony here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, there are four recognize culpable mental states. There are actually five. We won't get into it. Acting recklessly. If I shoot through a wall, that's a reckless act, whether I know there's something on the other side or not. Okay? And if, in fact, my reckless act causes injury, then that's the definition of recklessness. I'm not saying that there is no place for this kind of a law with a mental element, but this law eliminates it, period. So this is a strict liability offense. So, for example, I'm not going to give you an example, but there's a huge difference between intentional conduct or reckless conduct or even negligent conduct than there is no intent element, which is the way this bill is drafted. It is no defense that the defendant did not know or could not reasonably have known that the woman was pregnant. I don't know if I'm answering. I guess I'm not answering your question. In other words, let's say I park my car in a place which blocks the view of oncoming traffic, and it's a no parking zone. Let's assume it's something, right? And a car is coming through the intersection, and another car comes in that intersection, and there's a collision. And the view of the driver was obstructed by my illegally parked car. One of the people involved in the accident is a pregnant woman. Her fetus or unborn child is injured. She's not, but the fetus is. Me, as the parker of that car, under this law, would be subject to prosecution for aggravated murder if the fetus doesn't survive, or a Class B felony assault if it does. That's what I mean by eliminating the intent requirement altogether.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Mr. Blackman, there's three of us up here that are former law enforcement officers, and we have well over 80 years of experience here. I myself have 29 years. I disagree with your comments on what you mentioned about domestic violence. So,
thank you. Mr. Blackman, could you also help me have clarification in regard to what you identify, as stated, are the interests identified by the sponsor? I don't get any clarity from your written comments on page, what is it, 4. And I don't want to insert my own trying to understand what you're communicating there. Could you state for me what you believe are the interests identified by the sponsors?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I was really, I guess, inferring from press reports and the debate about whether the approach taken by 2020 or a Senate bill, I guess it's 712, that the sponsors here were seeking to have a legislative recognition of the sanctity of life from the moment of conception. And what I'm saying is that I think the approach this bill takes doesn't do that, because it doesn't require any acknowledgement or knowledge or ability to know that life is present.
Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Skye, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose House Bill 2020. I've submitted written testimony, which I believe has been distributed, and we have three primary reasons for our opposition to this bill. The first of those reasons was very eloquently and aptly covered by Mr. Blackman, so I will not belabor the point other than to echo that the bill's provisions in specifically providing that lack of knowledge is not a defense to any of the provisions of this bill, homicide, manslaughter, or the new crime that's created in Section 8. That departs greatly from established Oregon law, and Mr. Blackman's memo actually lays out for you that established Oregon law, and he's done a great deal of explaining. Coming here, you know, one of the things that I understand this bill to be doing is to try to protect it, or try to provide an extra layer of protection to an unborn fetus or to a pregnant mother. And again, I would echo what Mr. Blackman says in that deterrence only works when an offender knows what conduct it is that they're supposed to avoid. And so when you remove that knowledge requirement, deterrence no longer works. Second of all, as a trial lawyer, my role here before the legislature is to bring to light problems as I see them, as they would play out in the actual proof and defense of particular criminal provisions. And I see many problems, many costly problems, and I define cost on a number of levels, financially and also to the, you know, potential cost to the actual intended victim, the woman, in that we are politicizing the fact-finding process and we are putting her privacy at risk. As you go through this bill, we're putting a lot of focus on the idea of a homicide where it's going to be very clear whether or not a woman was pregnant. But when you look at Section 8 and you take the combination of a lack of mental state and the fact that this new crime created under Section 8 does not have a culpable mental state, you can come up with endless scenarios that are problematic. With as advanced of as science is, we are still often unable to determine a conception date. And because these offenses do not require that even the woman, the pregnant woman, know that she was pregnant, what we are doing is inviting a lot of litigation into whether the woman was pregnant when the actual offense occurred. I can see battling experts on the possibility of conception date and the possibility of whether the defendant's conduct actually caused an injury that wasn't discovered until the child was later born, or whether defendant's conduct actually caused an early delivery. All of this will take, again, the focus away from the intended victim, that being the woman, the pregnant woman, will cost a great deal of money. It's, in every case, it's very important to remember that when you go to court, the state has the requirement of proving each material element, and the defense has a constitutional right to challenge the state's evidence and to present a defense. The possible implications for the mother in this case and her privacy rights regarding her medical condition and her health care and her her sex life, for that matter, are grave. And it's something that you need to consider is how this will all play out in the courtroom. And I echo Representative Ackerman's concerns about the cost, because this is going to be costly litigation, both costly because it includes the death penalty, but because we're talking about science and experts that will need to be hired on behalf of the state, on behalf of the defense, the questions of whether, as Mr. Brackman mentioned whether every victim's going to be required to submit a pregnancy test, how the defense will be able to challenge that evidence, dating of pregnancy tests. There are all kinds of complications. The other thing that I see in regards to Section 8 creating the new crime, I've heard a lot of talk this morning about the exceptions for a lawful abortion and trying to protect the mother's choice on whether to carry the child to term. And there also is an exception in the homicide statute for homicide that's committed as a result of acts committed by the pregnant woman. In other words, if the pregnant woman acts in such a way that terminates her pregnancy, that she cannot be held accountable. I don't see, from my reading of the statute, that those exceptions apply to Section 8. So that would mean that that if a mother were to do something, perhaps she chose not to to carry this pregnancy to term, she is not protected from prosecution under Section 8 because these exceptions apply only to the homicide provisions of this bill. Likewise, the concern that was raised by Representative McPherson regarding exceptions for medical treatments, that again is an exception that would need to does not exist in this new crime created in Section 8, and certainly puts a great deal of medical practitioners at risk for prosecution. A lot of the examples that have been given by the proponents of this bill have revolved around the Lacey Peterson case and the Carrie Rep case, which were cases where the mothers were visibly pregnant, where the offenders clearly were aware of the consequences of their actions, that killing not only the mother but the fetus. This bill covers all levels of homicide, and similar to Mr. Blackman's example of the parked car that causes the death of an unborn fetus, at all levels of homicide within this bill, you will be sweeping in, you will be sweeping into this bill extra crimes to be prosecuted. And to take, for example, a case out of the Bend area that's receiving a lot of press right now regarding speed racing, you could have some kids speed racing. Say one of the drivers is a teenage girl. Unknown to her, she's pregnant. She engages in speed racing and gets in an accident and dies. The state in the autopsy learns that she's pregnant. Now, the other person who's been speed racing against her, despite the fact that their only intent was to speed race, they have recklessly caused not only the death of the driver of the other car, but they have inadvertently caused the death of an unborn fetus. And now we are prosecuting the driver of the other car for two manslaughters. So when you look at the provisions of a bill like this, it's important to think of all scenarios to which it will apply, and not only those scenarios that you read about in the paper, because it is those scenarios that a careful analysis uncovers. You will see that the people who will be prosecuted that were not clearly not intended to be prosecuted under this bill. And my final comment is that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is opposed in principle to the death penalty and will always be opposed to any expansion of its already broad provision.
Question, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ms. Guy, when you the speed racing thing, you example you just gave, you said would be charged with two manslaughters. Why not aggravated murder?
Correct.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Krieger, Representative Barker, I guess in looking at it, we're referring to what's in Section 2 of the bill, subsection 1F, the victim of an intentional homicide was a human being under the age of 14. So in that circumstance, I don't believe it would be an intentional homicide. It's a manslaughter, but it does then place the driver of that other car with two counts of manslaughter.
Okay, thank you. Okay, be aware this panel's got about 7 minutes.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. The ACLU opposes House Bill 2020 because it chips away at the legal foundation of a woman's right to choose abortion. It does not require the appropriate mental state to commit the crime, and it expands the death penalty in Oregon law. Let me first say at the outset that when a pregnant woman is a victim of a violent crime, the loss or harm to the fetus is an additional tragedy worthy of redress. Violent offenders who commit these crimes intending to cause harm to the fetus can and should be punished. The ACLU fully supports the proper punishment of violence against pregnant women that harms or kills their fetus. Instead of creating a separate offense, the law should increase the penalty when a criminal act results in the harm not only to a pregnant woman, but to her pregnancy. Such penalty enhancements punish the additional injury that these acts cause the woman without conferring on the fetus the status of a legal entity. Unlike fetal homicide or fetal harms legislation, such penalty enhancements focus the criminal law where it should be, on the additional, often devastating injury suffered by the woman when a crime harms or kills her fetus. Okay. However, this bill seeks to endow the fetus with legal rights distinct from the woman who's been injured or killed. It is not necessary to take this dramatic legal step to address the harms done. Although proponents argue that this bill is intended to punish violent offenders, it also has the effect of attempting to separate a woman from her fetus in the eyes of the law. Such separation sets the stage for eliminating a woman's right to determine the fate of her own pregnancy and to direct the course of her own health care. We believe that drafting the law in this manner is part of a larger strategy to overturn Roe v. Wade. If we look at how the U.S. Supreme Court has recently reanalyzed its earlier decisions, the strategy becomes clear. Let me explain. When last session, the court reexamined the issues of sodomy law in Lawrence v. Texas, overturning an earlier decision, Bowers v. Hardwick. The court looked at the history of sodomy laws and the prohibition of same-sex relations. It noted that over the course of the last few decades since its decision in Bowers, most states have moved towards abolishing sodomy laws. The court argued the evolution of community standards was one reason to justify the reversal of a prior precedent permitting sodomy laws. The same analysis was used in 2002 when the Supreme Court compared the number of states that now bar execution of those who are mentally retarded in overturning an earlier decision. In fact, Justice Scalia made clear in his dissent in Lawrence that he supports overturning Roe on this basis. That is why we say that this law chips away at the legal foundation of a woman's right to choose abortion. The proponents intend to use the argument that the recognition of the fetus at all stages of gestation as an independent victim of crime justifies the reversal of Roe, holding that a fetus is not a person under the Constitution. As Senator Orrin Hatch told CNN in speaking about the federal equivalent to this proposal, they say it undermines abortion rights. It does. Unquote. We are further troubled by some of the details of House Bill 2020. By explicitly disavowing a mens rea or criminal intent requirement with respect to the harm of the fetus, this creates a tension with the Constitution's due process guarantees. This bill would permit a person to be convicted of the offense of killing a fetus even if he or she did not know and had no reason to know that the woman was pregnant and he or she did not intend to cause the harm of the fetus. Such a result undermines the Constitution's promise of due process. Finally, this bill expands the aggravated murder statute in Oregon, thus expanding the application of the death sentence. The ACLU opposes use of the death penalty. In past sessions, the ACLU, along with the Catholic Conference and our other allies, has opposed any attempt to expand the death penalty in Oregon, and we do so here again today. The ACLU urges you to reject House Bill 2020. Instead, We should follow the model set forth in North Carolina, where both anti-choice and pro-choice legislators work to pass legislation that enhances the penalties for violent acts that cause a miscarriage or stillbirth. This law appropriately punishes the additional injury a woman suffers without identifying the fetus as a legal entity separate and distinct from the woman harmed. If we are truly committed to addressing violence against women, we will develop legislation that punishes the crime and does not involve us with either a debate over abortion or a debate over the death penalty. Thank you.
Any questions?
Just so I understand, what you're saying is that if you increase the penalties for harming a woman's pregnancy, that there would just be charges brought, let's say the woman is killed and the unborn baby, fetus, how whatever name you want to attach to it, is also killed, that it would just be one murder or assault or whatever the sentence is, it would just be one, not two?
Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher, depending on whether it's harm or killing, it would focus on the injury done to the woman and then add an element to it. And I should say very clearly that because the ACLU opposes the death penalty, it would not be a situation that would then elevate a crime that's not available under the aggravated murder statutes to become part of the aggravated murder statutes. But otherwise, in terms of the sentencing options, and the criminal defense lawyers can speak to that far better than I, but that it would elevate it. It would be an additional injury to which needs to be proved that it occurred. But it would not treat the fetus separately in terms of a distinct life. But it would absolutely recognize that either injury or death was done to the fetus.
I just have one question, Mr. Chair. In light of House Bill 2020, do you feel that, I'll ask you the same question I've asked a few others to Andrea. Is there a distinction that's identified in House Bill 2020 between criminal act versus that of what the law allows through choice?
Chair Krieger, Representative Olson, I think there's an attempt, but I think it is a very one slippery slope, and I think is already adequately described. It is unintended consequences, and I think it certainly creates the exposure to the access to legal and safe abortion at risk in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Actually, I do have sort of a slow follow-up here from the previous question. Under the North Carolina model, if the mother should, perhaps she was subjected to severe domestic violence, she lived, however, her baby dies, what would be the application of the North Carolina model in that instance?
Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher, in looking at North Carolina law, which I'm happy to make available to committee members, it's pretty brief, but it would create it as one class higher than the felony committed. I think I'm reading it, trying to read it in context for you, and I haven't memorized all the details. I think what my purpose of bringing forward the issue of North Carolina with needing to take into account opposition and not creating another aggravated sentence is that we can carefully try to craft out something that addresses the various potential scenarios in a manner that recognizes the injury done without creating a separate life and without bringing in the death penalty. I don't have specific language in front of me to tell you in each scenario what would happen, and part of that is due to my lack of expertise in the criminal law practice, which I know others are better adept at discussing that.
Just to clarify, so an assault done on the woman would just be an aggravated assault, perhaps, rather than, you know, where it results in the death of her child that maybe was scheduled to be born the next day, for instance, or it wouldn't be recognized as a separate life. That's what I'm understanding. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher, again, I apologize not having the details, but yes, it would need to have taken, it would not create it as a separate life, but it would create an elevating to the assault of the woman and then the death of the fetus.
and it would elevate it. When we talk about elevating it, we're making it longer sentence. We're punishing the person for that act, and that intentional act. So I want to be clear when we talk about it that we are talking about increasing punishment, recognizing and acknowledging that there was more than one injury done here.
Committee members, I've got to get Senator Brown up in a moment. Ms. Representative McPherson's will be the last question of this group.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question really for any member of the panel, and it doesn't need to be a long response, but if Oregon were to enact House Bill 2020, would that place it within the mainstream of the development of criminal justice, or would it be at an extreme?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, you know, my personal opinion is that it does place it at the extreme for a couple of reasons that we've discussed. One is removing the knowledge requirement. Having no culpable mental state makes it a strict liability offense, which is extreme because you're punishing somebody for conduct that not only did they not intend, but they were not aware of. And second of all, because of the way the bill treats a fetus as a separate human being, obviously it's politicizing, it's putting a separate political issue, as Ms. Meyer has discussed, into criminal justice policy, and it's politicizing what goes on in the courtroom. It's politicizing justice, and in that respect, I believe that it's extreme as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Senator Brown. Sorry we had to hold you up so long.
No problem. The governor was running late today, so. Good morning, Chair Krieger and committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify this morning. I appreciate this is a very difficult issue with strong feelings on all sides. Nonetheless, it's encouraging to see such universal interest in seriously addressing one of the most awful forms of violence. My overriding concern about House Bill 2020 is that it does not address the problem of domestic violence during a woman's pregnancy. Nationally, approximately 30 to 50% of female homicides are perpetrated by an intimate or former intimate partner. In contrast, only 5% of male homicides are perpetrated by an intimate or former partner. Abuse during pregnancy is one of several risk factors for domestic violence homicides. Estimates vary, but the majority of national studies report that 4 to 8% of women report physical or sexual violence during pregnancy. A 2003 Department of Human Services study in Oregon showed that 25% of the 100 homicides committed that year were committed by intimate partners. That's 25 for those of you that are math impaired like I am. I did want to note, I heard Mr. Blackman's testimony. The intimate partner homicides in Oregon report reports that intimate partner homicides in Oregon have remained relatively stable over the past 7 years of surveillance, with an average annual rate of fewer than one per 100,000 Oregonians aged 12 years and older. The number of cases has ranged from a low of 14 in 1999 to a high of 21 in years 2000 and 2001. What we do not know, unlike the number of other states that have studied the issue, is whether homicide is the leading cause of maternal mortality in Oregon. We just do not have the data. The passage of a bill that would establish a multidisciplinary team to investigate these crimes would go a long way toward providing us with this important information. Anecdotally, I've learned in conversations with district attorneys that while crimes like the homicide of Carrie Rapp are both devastating and extremely frightening, they are rare, occurring perhaps once a decade in this state. But if you talk with folks in the DA's office, individual DAs will tell you that assaults during pregnancy are not unusual. If we do nothing else this session, it is imperative that we pass an assault upgrade that would enhance penalties for assaulting a pregnant woman when the perpetrator knew or should have known that the woman was pregnant. This knowledge requirement is significant, but it, because it acknowledges the domestic violence component of these assaults and recognizes the particular vulnerability of pregnant women in abusive relationships. Passing an assault upgrade this session would build on the work we did in 1997 when we enhanced penalties for multiple assaults or assaults committed in the presence of a child. The other dire need in the state are services adequate to meet the needs of women in domestic violence situations. We spend a few $1 million each biennium to meet the needs of Oregon women who suffer abuse. Until 2001, the sole source of funding for domestic violence services was the marriage license fee, which funded services such as shelter beds, counseling, and anger management. In 2001, after a lot of hard work, we were successful in providing the first general fund allocation for domestic violence services. Given the present budget shortfall, the governor's budget reduces those dollars by about 10%. I urge your opposition to House Bill 2020 because it fails to adequately address the serious problem of increased risk of domestic violence during pregnancy. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do any members have any questions of Senator?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to have Denise Washington, and I think it's is it Marcy Kelly? Come up, please. Please state your names for the record when you get ready to speak.
Good morning. My name is Denise Washington, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And Chair Krieger and members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to provide this testimony this morning. I'm a little bit nervous, so please bear with me. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence was established in 1978. It is a statewide support network for the domestic violence and the rape crisis centers throughout Oregon who have been working to end violence against women in our state. The Oregon Coalition, or OCADSV, strongly opposes House Bill 2020, which would enhance the penalties for the homicide of a pregnant woman and criminalize an assault on an unborn child, effectively creating a second crime of each event. The pregnancy could be at any stage of development, and there's no requirement that the perpetrator even be aware of the pregnancy. That puts women at greater risk. Our concern is that the bill does not focus on protecting women against violence, while it purports to do so. What we know in our field is when you keep women safe, when you keep mothers safe, you keep children safe. We do believe in supporting sentencing enhancements. And in this manner, we believe that the Oregon legislature can advance both its goal of protecting the victims of domestic violence and providing a legal sanction as a result of battering. Sentencing enhancement appropriately punishes such acts without causing unnecessary and potentially dangerous consequences for the women that we see at shelters every day. This bill, however, goes further than sentencing enhancements. While there are exceptions for lawful abortion and acts of the pregnant woman, it opens the door to a dangerous trend for neglect or failure to protect charges to be made against pregnant mothers who are abused because of harm done to the pregnancy by the batterer. Legislation regarding violence against women must be carefully considered in order to prevent unintended consequences from hurting the very women it is supposed to help. Battered women cannot control the violence against them, and they should not face the possibility of prosecution simply because they are victims of domestic violence. While the bill has obvious good intentions, and we applaud that, we're concerned that it may not fulfill its larger purpose of creating a legal atmosphere in which women feel protected from violence. Providing sentencing enhancement to address injury and harm would maintain the focus of criminal prosecution on the intended victim of violence, the battered woman. Safety for pregnant women
indeed all women, is crucial. The Oregon legislature would provide a much more effective response by fully funding the life-saving core intervention services for victims, such as shelter, rape crisis line, hotlines, and providing staff for those services so that they may be provided to the women of Oregon on a 24-hour-a-day basis. Further efforts focused on the woman's safety would include comprehensive health care, early intervention, and safety planning for domestic violence victims, and advocacy at the programs that I previously mentioned. I'd also like to point out that, as Senator Brown spoke earlier, programs in this state are facing a 10% reduction in funding. In 2001, $2.5 million was appropriated by this very legislature. For the first time, funding came from the general fund to support programs and thereby support women and children who are fleeing from violence. So while I applaud this effort to maintain safety for women, I believe that another way to show support is to fully fund those programs and to be sure that services, shelters, and hotlines are available so that there is a phone number for women to call when they're experiencing violence. So there's a place of safety that women can go to when they're experiencing violence. This is truly preventive and will truly do more to safeguard pregnant women than the bill before us. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
President Flores.
Thank you, Ms. Washington. In your experience advocating for services and shelters and hotlines for women who are subject to domestic violence or potentially subject to domestic violence, are you aware of women who actually then are, regardless of those safeguards and provisions, are murdered?
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, indeed that does happen.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any statistics that you might be able to provide us that would show the numbers in correlation to the women who receive the benefits of these good services and yet are still victims in the most heinous situation? They're actually murdered.
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, I'm not sure that the statistics appear in the form that you're requesting. I'd certainly endeavor to do research on that and bring it back to the committee.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I wear two hats today due to the illness of one of the public policy co-chairs for the American Association of University Women. I do serve as a legislative coordinator for AUW of Oregon. We have 28 branches around the state in every place from Lakeview to Pendleton to Seaside and, of course, Portland. We are not in support of House Bill 2020 because we, like others before us, don't believe that this is addressing the underlying issue of violence against pregnant women or women at all. And I'm not going to reiterate all of the things that one of our members at large, Representative Nolan, spoke to earlier, because we do agree. We do thank you for this opportunity to come before you. I am also the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And as that coalition's lobbyist, I do need to tell you that our members, the American Association of University Women of Oregon, the Oregon National Organization of Women, and the Oregon Women's Political Caucus members are in opposition to this bill. In addition, register concerns that the ACLU did regarding the slippery slope in limiting women's right to choose in the attempt to define a human being that is in conflict with what the U.S. Supreme Court held in as a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. I am not a lawyer, so I am not going to answer technical lawyer questions. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, is murder violent?
Murder is violent, yes.
Then how can you say that this bill does not address violence against women?
Because it does not adequately speak to other things that can be done, and we do not think that the bill, the way that it's written, focuses on women.
Follow, Mr. Chair? So the statement here, though, that it does not address the issue of violence against women, that's wrong. What you're saying is it doesn't go far enough in encompassing more violence against women.
It does not go far enough, correct. But it also brings in to the equation almost, you know, the unnecessity for the woman.
Thank you. Jonathan Clark here today. Come up, Jonathan. And also Myrna Shanefield.
Chairman Krieger, representatives, may it please the committee. I'm Jonathan Clark. I'm an Oregon attorney, Oregon father, Oregon husband, and like you, I'm a former unborn child, although it may not have been so many years ago. House Bill 2020 expresses a tremendous bipartisan truth that unborn children are one of us. House Bill 2020 says to the unborn children, we were there, and you'll be here, and we're going to empower prosecutors to seek justice against those who injure you. The text expands the criminal homicide law. Right now, those of us in the room are already protected against by murder, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide. The bill extends those protections to the unborn child. It creates a crime of assault on the unborn child, and I'll speak more about that in a few moments. And it makes the unborn child a legal victim. We already know that an unborn child is a victim when it's injured in a crime committed against its mother. The House bill makes the unborn child a legal victim. And in doing that, it gives voice to the value that we all share. The passion to protect human life bridges the liberal and conservative divide. The passion to protect human life transcends the squabbles we have as grown-ups about our political philosophy. When we listen to pregnant women and their families, we know that we're talking about living children who are not yet born. We talk about them and we prepare for them as if they're human, as if they're already one of us. We say, how's the baby? Not how's the fetus. Women say, I'm eating for two, because there are two. We sing to them, we pray with them and we pray for them, we read to them, we touch them, we feel them move, and we name them. We even now perform surgery on them for their health and for their well-being. The press also gives voice to this perception of children. In the Oregonian, there was a story about a woman named Alejandra who was stabbed in her abdomen. And she did not die but her baby did. And the Oregonian, in covering that story, referred to this as a death of the baby. It was also, I think, the woman who spoke for the ACLU discussed a fetus dying. Something cannot die if it doesn't live. And if it lives, it's a member of a species. And our onboard children are members of our species. They are human beings. Alejandra's story is anecdotal, but it's not isolated. The Washington Post, which has, by all signs, not yet fallen to the vast right-wing conspiracy, was so alarmed about the numbers of pregnant women suffering violence that they ran a three-article series. One of the articles was in December last year. And in it, they cited a study from the Journal of the American Medical Association saying that homicide is the leading cause of death for pregnant women. And why is that? Because the criminals that are killing pregnant women are going after the babies that are living within them. In the criminals' minds, there are two victims. Our laws should reflect that. The strength of House Bill 2020 is that it equips prosecutors to punish wrongdoing. We may hope that our laws deter, and we may hope that our system rehabilitates, but our laws must punish wrongdoing. To kill or to injure a child that has not yet been born is to kill or to injure one of us. There are two lives, there are two crimes, there should be two punishments. House Bill 2020 does not offend the Constitution. Representative Nelson, I heard you say that there were 15 states that have fetal homicide laws. By my count, there are 30 states that have fetal homicide laws, but I'm a plaintiff's attorney, and I've never seen a number I like that I wasn't willing to double, so you may be right, but I suspect that the accurate number is 30 states currently have fetal homicide laws. That puts Oregon, which should be a leader, behind the game and brings us back into the mainstream, not on the extreme, but back into the mainstream. By my count, also 9 challenges to those laws have been brought forth. Not a single one has succeeded. The law, each of those fetal homicide laws, the state fetal homicide laws, has withstood constitutional challenges because House Bill 2020 does not offend the right to an abortion. In Oregon, we understand our laws, first of all, by reading them, fortunately, and not reading press releases. The text of House Bill 2020 is very clear. A person does not commit criminal homicide if the death is of an unborn child and occurs, A, during a lawful abortion performed with a pregnant woman's consent. Besides the plain text of the bill, we can turn to the United States Supreme Court's abortion-related jurisprudence. In Webster and Roe, it's clear that we can extend privileges and protections to an unborn child without offending a woman's right to choose. Finally, House Bill 2020 does not put a pregnant woman at risk of criminal prosecution. Some reference was made moments ago to Section 8. And again, if we read the plain text of Section 8, in subpart 1, a person commits the crime of assault of an unborn child if the person knowingly causes physical injury to the mother of an unborn child. And here are the key words, without the mother's consent. Well, there was a discussion about medical treatment. Proper medical treatment is with consent. And so there isn't any unexpected prosecution on a doctor. I request your support and your advocacy for House Bill 2020. It's philosophically sound. It gives voice to a value that we all share. And House Bill 2020 is a clear statement of the universal value. An unborn child is a human being. Babies and unborn babies are one of us. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to present today. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, do you have any questions? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what would prevent a situation under this bill where a woman who is in her first trimester has a spontaneous abortion or miscarries from alleging, say, her husband or her boyfriend caused that miscarriage? What kind of preventions are there from false accusations like that? How can you track a spontaneous abortion or miscarriage and verify that it was not done due to some act against the woman?
Okay. Chairman Krieger, Representative Worth, I suspect that the protections that exist against false accusations are the same that would exist in all of our criminal law. First of all, that guilt has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think we can pass no criminal law where false accusations are not a danger. And so I don't know that there are specific, and I don't know that there are need, that specific protections against that are needed in this case. If there's an example that that's not coming to my mind, I'd be happy to respond to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just know that there's a lot of criticism against, say, the overuse, apparently, of restraining orders in certain situations. So I'm just thinking, I'm both my pregnancies, I almost lost both children during the first trimester. And what would prevent me from accusing my husband at the time if there's no way to track and be sure that what caused that miscarriage? There's just...
There has to be an action by somebody else against the woman. So if a man committed an act against a woman and then the woman miscarried, she would have a basis for her allegation. If a restraining order is in place, or if there has to be some contact between the perpetrator and the woman, I don't think an allegation could just simply be made without any kind of connection between what a perpetrator did and what happened to the woman.
Final clarification. Well, is he said against she, is her word against his? If I suffer a miscarriage, I can, under this law, can't I allege that it was that someone struck me or he shook me or something? There's so many things that can cause a miscarriage that it's very vague.
Right. So yes, I think a criminal prosecution under House Bill 2020 would be like many other criminal prosecutions, where it comes down to the testimony of witnesses and a jury's responsibility to decide which witness they choose to believe. Similar to the conversation about experts coming in, not much different than any other criminal or civil case.
Mr. Clark, you were referring to the issue of consent to medical procedures, and with respect to the assault piece in Section 8 of the bill, I'm wondering whether the consent exception would be sufficient in its instances where there was not an opportunity to gain consent, either because the pregnant woman is underage or it was in a case of emergency medical services when she was not in a conscious state to give that consent. And then let me link up the related question, which is the only consent exception I see in the homicide portion of the bill relates to a lawful abortion. So if it were a death that occurred, that it would seem to be without the consent exception. Am I reading the bill right?
Would you state the last part, Chairman Krieger, Representative McPherson, would you state the second part again?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I did throw a lot at you there. The second part is that there are two pieces to the bill, really, as I read it. There's an assault piece, which is in Section 8, and there's a homicide piece, which starts in Section 1. And the homicide piece has an exception for a lawful abortion,
with the woman's consent. But I don't see an exception other than for a lawful abortion in the homicide piece. So where there was an action undertaken by, say, a medical professional, and it were to result in the termination of a pregnancy about which that medical professional knew nothing, because the bill doesn't require any knowledge. My reading of the bill is that that would subject that individual to criminal prosecution under the homicide piece. And then the first piece, just to remind you, is that under the assault portion of the bill, the consent exception, is that effective as an exception in cases where the mother, the woman carrying the child, isn't able to give consent either because she's underage or because she's not in a conscious state because she's receiving emergency medical service.
Representative Chairman Krieger, Representative McPherson, I don't know that I can fully answer your question. I believe the answer is that the same protections would apply to a medical professional as he operates or performs some kind of service for a medical woman as would apply if he assisted one of us as he came on the scene of an accident. I believe he'd have the same protections if we weren't able to consent as he would have if the pregnant woman were not able to consent.
Okay. No follow-up, Mr. Chair, although I'd say there's some troublesome mechanics to the bill.
Just as we were looking at Section 8, I just had an additional question for you with respect to Sub A and Sub B, which are threshold requirements for the or elements of the commission of the crime. A, causing serious physical injury to the unborn child, or, and this is what I'm concerned about, causing the unborn child to be born prior to 37 weeks gestation and a child weighs 2,500 grams or less at time of birth. Do you know what standard we're referring to here? Is this a medical standard, a legal standard, or would you know?
Chairman Krieger, Representative Ackerman, I do not know.
Would you concede, however, that Sub B only refers to the birth of a single child and does not contemplate the birth, multiple births, such as twins or triplets?
Representative Krieger, Chairman Krieger, Representative Ackerman, I'm not sure that I would concede that other than to say yes. It does refer to an unborn child, but each of the twins or triplets would be covered as an unborn child.
I understand that, but my point being that in multiple births, you might have a normal situation where the children would be born before 37 weeks gestation and weigh 2,500 grams or less each, and yet a crime would be committed even though... I think the threshold relates to single rather than multiple births. Would you concede that?
By text.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Olson.
Just one real quick question. Mr. Clark, regarding the threshold there in Section 8, subsections A and B, where was that terminal or that threshold obtained from?
Representative Chairman Krieger, Representative Olson, I don't know that.
Okay.
Other questions? Please.
For the record, my name is Myrna Schoenfeld. I'm from Grants Pass, Oregon. I'm here because Representative Anderson is our representative in our area, and I'm here to support the bill. And I thank you for allowing me to be here at this moment to speak out in support of the bill. First of all, I'm a mother of three, grandmother 16. And I just attended the hearings in Southern Oregon for the Rules Committee on Senator Brown's proposal and her bill. But it's notes that I've been taking here and I'd like to bring out for the prestigious committee is that, first of all, there is a Federal Unborn Victim Violence Act, and it is the law of the land now. It has been passed by President Bush and sign an action. So all these questions that you're deliberating and asking right now, it's already being done by 30 states. They've already gone through this, and we also have the federal law. Now, if Carrie Rep, who is from our area, was murdered because of this law that's been in action, if she was murdered on federal property, like a military base, there would be, here in Oregon, tried, her husband would be tried for two crimes. But because she was murdered in her home, the crime is only one. And so it's very, all these other questions that you're having, you could bring it and look at the federal law that's already being enacted right now on federal property. That your questions would seem almost moot at this point because it is federal law of the land. It has not affected the abortion decision, so somebody fearful of. I feel that that is important to investigate as thoroughly as you're doing, but also to help to keep it simple. We always say KISS, you know, keep it simple. We have two victims, two crimes. We have 30 states that have already doing this and having this violent, this what you call the laws protecting or pursuing increased violence, increased prosecution for the violence against a pregnant woman. And again, we're talking about her unborn child. We're not talking about an elephant or an animal or anything. We're talking about the unborn child that's been recognized here in the case. It's her choice to carry this child, and she has now been murdered, and her baby has been murdered. And keeping it in that simplicity, when the testimony is opposing it, I'm overwhelmed with the fact that they're still denying the justice to the unborn child. It's not a debate on abortion. Carrie Rep's parents, Mrs. Johnson, was there when she had her moving testimony, like Mr. Grinsky today. It's heart-wrenching. And she admitted that she is wearing around her neck the ashes of her unborn child that was murdered. And that this, again, she recognizes the humanity of her grandchild that she's been deprived of in life. And so, for simplicity's sake, we're just trying to bring to your attention justice for both. Just that simple. And I would ask you to consider passing and supporting this bill 2020 as it has been presented. And I thank you.
Do any members have any questions or comments? Okay, thank you both. We are up to almost our time allotment here, and I've got to release the committee to go to floor session. We have five people, I believe, signed up for public testimony. If you do want to do that, it will be at 3 o'clock this afternoon in this room. Hate to have to hold you over. Appreciate the committee's work and all those in the audience and the people that testified. It's a difficult issue to deal with, but hopefully we'll find some answers. We'll be recessed till 3. I apologize for you, all of you that weren't able to get in this morning. We did run over a little bit, but we felt that an open process where the public actually did have could partake in this was more important than staying to a very, very strict timeline. I'm going to call up, I think we have about 5 or 6 altogether people. Amy, is it Rabin? Rabin? Rabin?
Destiny?
I'll do the two of you separate before I call anyone else. Go ahead.
Thank you.
State your names, please, for the record.
My name is Amy Rabin, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to speak. I come to you today from Oregonians for Life, which is our organization, against House Bill 2020. And the reason why I am against it, for many reasons, but one of the reasons why I'm against House Bill 2020 is because in 1969 I was born and I was given up for adoption. The Italian family that I was born to was a wealthy, proud Italian family that wasn't very happy that their daughter got pregnant. They sent her to an unwed mother's home, and I was given up for adoption. So essentially, I wasn't wanted, as this bill discusses. But there was an Irish family a couple hundred miles away that did want me. So the terminology in this bill of wanted child and unwanted child really isn't relevant. For every year, there are more abortions than there are people that can adopt those children. The people that want to adopt those children far exceed the amount of people that have an abortion. So the word wanted in terms of this bill is one of the things that I would like to dispute. But also, one of the things that could really solve a lot of the problems I see here is having a penal code section change so that we wouldn't be having to discuss this. California's penal code section for murder, section 187, says that murder is the deliberate killing of a human being or fetus with malice aforethought. I think that that's one of the things. If we changed that, there wouldn't be discussion on when life begins or if it's murder, if someone's shot, if what someone's intent was. The fact that two lives would be taken would just be that, the two lives would be taken. So that's one of the things. Also, it gives a confusing message because a stranger would be able to shoot a woman in the stomach and he would be charged with two murders. And if that same woman went six blocks away and paid someone to do the exact same act, which was to kill the child that's inside of her, there wouldn't be any problem with that. So we're determining just by that action that the man's guilty of two murders. When, if we say that, then we admit that that's life, and the definition of murder is taking a life. So that's what I'd like to say. Thank you very much.
Committee members, do you have any questions? Morning. Okay.
My name is Destiny Raven. Thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Esther Rabin because my mom got pregnant while she was in a leg cast that went all the way up to her hip. I know she wasn't very happy that she was pregnant because her injury was very bad and she was going to have the cast for at least 1 year. The doctor told her that she could have an abortion, but she said no way. I was born April 16th, 1992, and now you know why my name is Destiny. When a woman is pregnant, she's going to have a baby. House Bill 2020 tells us that if a woman wants that child, it is a child in the eyes of the law. If she doesn't, then it is not. The logic they teach me in school tells me that this is illogical. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Can I ask your mom a question? Sure.
Correct.
Just clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, you said you were from you were representing a pro-life group.
I am.
Is that correct? And the last point you made about it being, you're sending a contradictory message, could you clarify that a little bit more?
Well, what I think that we're saying is that when it's convenient, it is a child. And when it's not convenient, then we just won't deem it that it's human. We're telling it's okay to murder on this hand, and it's not okay to murder on this hand. It's inconsistent.
Well, Mr. Chair, so would you suggest any changes in the bill? How would you suggest to make it consistent?
I think that a simple change in our penal code under the definition of murder would do that. California didn't have to go through this with Lacey Peterson because their definition of murder, the deliberate killing of a human being or fetus with malice aforethought, covered that. So there wasn't this discussion. But if abortion was just taken out of this bill, the discussion of abortion, I think it's a perfectly good bill. But if you say, okay, well, you can, if somebody shoots a woman in the stomach, then he's guilty of murder, but she can go down the same exact day to an abortion clinic and have the pregnancy terminated, the same act.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, I have a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I guess I'll ask you the same question that I've asked some other folks, too. I wasn't finding to it, but now that you've brought that up to this light, I do want, having taken into consideration House Bill 2020, do you feel that there's a distinction between the criminal act versus what the law allows through choice?
As the bill's written, I don't believe there is. Philosophically, I know there is.
Okay, fine.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Ron, I'm going to wait for you for probably last. That'd be all right. I had three on the list from this morning. I don't know if they've all remained or not. Mary Sterrett, would you come up, please? And is there a Paul? Is it DePari or DePari? DePari. DePari? Wasn't too far off. And also a David Brownlow. Is he still here?
Yeah.
Thank you for taking your time to wait on us. We were busy this morning. And please state your names.
My name is Mary Sterrett, representing Oregonians for Life. And I would like to thank the committee and Mr. Chair for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. I would like to pretty much echo what Amy and Destiny have talked about, and that is basically that this bill, in its present form, does not make sense. It's filled with basic contradictions. And what that basic contradiction is we heard earlier this morning that people were concerned that it would undermine Roe v. Wade. And I think that's a distinct opposition to what is really, in fact, going on in this bill. It does not undermine Roe v. Wade. What it does is it rather more firmly commits us to acceptance of Roe v. Wade, in that all this bill says is if you are, quote, wanted, we heard that earlier from Speaker Minnis all the way through the morning session, that if you are wanted, your right to life exists. If you are unwanted, that very basic right does not exist. It might seem counterintuitive to those who are listening to an anti-abortion group, a pro-life sentiment, say that House Bill 2020 is really counter to our hopes and our wishes regarding these types of legislation. This group, Oregonians for Life, we believe that House Bill 2020 which makes causing the death of an unborn child a criminal homicide, it is a noble and it is a worthy expansion of homicide law. But we believe that this bill will further entrench into law and into our society this basic legitimizing murder for hire. In other words, I can pay someone to end the life of my child. I can self-induce the termination of my own pregnancy, and that is acceptable under this law. However, if the very same process happens with a stranger in a dark alley, we then deem that to be something that is criminal and homicidal in intent. We believe that this type of law does nothing but further the belief that killing babies is acceptable for some and not for others. And there was a consideration earlier, Representative Ackerman, about the fiscal impact of this. My suggestion would be, in summation, is that if we're concerned about how we're going to pay for the impact of criminalizing the killing of an unborn child, which I believe is fine. However, what I would like to say is if we're concerned about where we're going to get the money to do that, perhaps we could take some of the $3 million plus that's been allocated in the biennial budget and for abortions, for taxpayer-funded abortions, and instead of doing that, we can go ahead and pay for if there is any fiscal impact to this bill. So in summation, I would just like to say that this does not undermine Roe v. Wade. This is not pro-life legislation. What this is a bill which in essence says it's okay to pay someone to kill your child. It's not okay if someone does it for free. Thank you for your time.
Committee members, any questions?
Question, thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as I understand it, the Oregon Right to Life is in support of the bill. Is that correct?
I don't know. I don't represent Oregon Right to Life. We believe that this is by no means a pro-life bill, and we are in many respects very much not on the same page as Oregon Right to Life. This is Oregonians for Life, and I do, as I said earlier, believe this is distinctly not a pro-life bill. So what they believe, I can't speak to.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Yes, my name is Paul DePerry, Mr. Chair and representatives, and appreciate this opportunity. I have six children, five of them girls, and 14 grandchildren, one still unborn. So I have some familiarity with the concerns of someone who's worried about what might happen during a pregnancy. Two of my daughters have been victims of rape, and, you know, I've been through a lot of this stuff. I have not had a daughter killed. But my primary message here is to those of you who think in terms of life, who believe, who are pro-life. I just want to tell you, this bill is not pro-life. This sets, for the first time, to my knowledge, in Oregon law, abortion as a legitimate practice. As far as I've been able to determine, there is not one law on the books of Oregon that says abortion is legitimate. There's just no law against abortion. And this, for the first time, will statutorily recognize abortion, the killing of a child. How can that be pro-life? That isn't pro-life. And as has been mentioned before, it continues the distinction, the discrimination, the double standard that we have between the wanted and the unwanted. Senator Minnis herself, a supporter of this bill, that was her entire message, was it protected wanted children. The whole idea of pro-life is to protect the unwanted children. And so this is not a pro-life bill. It sends the wrong message. The message that society has, in large part, already accepted, that it's okay to kill unwanted people when you preserve the lives of wanted people. That's not the message we need to send there. We punish one man for doing something because he needs some money and he goes out and does a robbery and kills some woman and her child. And we pay with our money, with our tax money, through the legislature, somebody else down at Lovejoy Clinic to kill another child the same day. Does this make sense? Is this pro-life? Absolutely not. Now, my solution, my remedy, is that we take the definition of human being and write it so that it includes the unborn. Now, everybody's going to say, oh, but, you know, that's unconstitutional because of Roe versus Wade. Courts are not likely to take statutes and declare them unconstitutional if they are construed in such a way as to exclude certain things. And what will happen, as what has happened in many states where they have laws still on the books criminalizing abortion, is that those statutes are construed not to apply to abortion. But at least, if you're pro-life, you're not going to be voting for something that dehumanizes the unwanted child and that says, right in its own language, that abortion is acceptable in the state of Oregon. The courts will construe this statute so that it doesn't apply to abortion, but at least you don't have to put it into words and put it into the statute. There's an old saying that the law is a great teacher. I don't think that as pro-life people, those of us that are pro-life, want to teach the people of Oregon that Oregon thinks that abortion is an acceptable behavior. And that's all I have to say. Thank you, sir. And any questions? I'll answer.
Committee members, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Ms. Sterrett. There are 30 states in the country that have some form of unborn children as victims laws. And do you categorize all 30 states then in the same with in the same category as you're asserting here today?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, no, I don't believe I do. I haven't read them all, but if I understand one of the former speakers earlier, Amy,
The California statute simply states that the homicide is the killing of a human being or a fetus. That would not dehumanize. It doesn't have this exceptions clause that says it's okay to have abortions or anything like that. It's a different wording. So if this statute were to be changed so that all you did was just basically define human being in a way that would include those unborn children without making a specific statement excluding abortion as some kind of a, you know, legitimate practice, then it would be a completely different matter. But as it stands, the current statute, flat out, and like I said, for the very first time in Oregon law, states that abortion is a legitimate practice.
Thank you, Mr. DePerry. Ms. Starrett?
May I just add to that, Mr. Chairman and representatives? I agree with that, and I concur with everything that Mr. DePerry said. However, the only thing I would add to that is we do not need to concede in the body of this bill, which criminalizes the killing of an unborn child, which I think it should. We do not need to concede that it is thusly all right on the one hand, to pay someone to do it. So all I'm saying is that particular aspect of this bill is what makes it inconsistent. So the other states, I don't know what the wording of theirs is. I do know that in this particular bill, the wording simply gives way more ground than we should as pro-life people be granting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Comments? Okay, thank you very much. Mark Luca, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Luca. And though I do work in the House for a few of your colleagues, I'd like to state for the record that my testimony today is my own and not on behalf of any member of the legislature. Please indulge me for a moment, if it pleases the committee, to allow me to provide some background as to my involvement with this issue. My experience outside the legislature is largely in criminal justice and private security fields. I served approximately 6 years as a volunteer deputy sheriff in Oregon, and before that I served in a non-sworn capacity for a small city police department in California. I have nearly, in total, 15 years experience dealing with issues relating to law enforcement. In 2002, prior to my coming to work for Representative Anderson in 2003 session, I worked as a security director for the Rogue Valley Mall in Medford. And it was there that I met one of Kerry Rep's best friends who worked for the shopping center, as well as one of my employees who was a witness for that very same case. And in speaking with Carrie's friend, I learned of the pain that she and the Johnson family were enduring as a result of learning that Carrie's murderer would face no charges for the death of Carrie's unborn child. And upon arriving in Salem with Representative Anderson, we discussed some of the ideas about conforming Oregon's laws to the emerging national standard by proposing the so-called fetal homicide bill. Representative Anderson asked me to contact the Johnsons and ask if they were interested in having a bill to remedy the law's lack of regard for their unborn grandchild. And they indicated that they were. And so I went to work with Representative Anderson drafting what became House Bill 3501 in the 2003 session. The bill, however, was never granted a hearing. I was excited this session to see that Speaker Minnis had taken leadership on this issue by introducing House Bill 2020, and that leads me to my testimony before you today. House Bill 2020 corrects a glaring injustice in Oregon law. Currently, Oregon law, by its silence, declares that a fetus has no value. Regardless of our individual and varied opinions on when life begins, I believe that everyone in this room can agree, whatever it is, fetus, unborn child, or pregnancy, it has value. Proposed alternatives you heard of earlier, such as Senate Bill 712, while potentially valuable and not mutually exclusive, do not go far enough and are of too limited scope to address the full scale of the problem. These bills deal only with acts of violence and only acts in which the expectant mother is harmed. These are worthy goals, but in trying as they do to dance around the real issue, they don't address the full range of the issues facing pregnant women, and as they protect her body, but not her choice. For example, suppose a pregnant woman is driving in her car, and a drunk driver hits her car. She's uninjured, but the event jars her unborn baby in such a way that the pregnancy is terminated. If she were indeed uninjured, the only crime that the other driver could be charged with is driving under the influence, a misdemeanor. Or, perhaps in a heated domestic dispute, a man pushes his pregnant wife and she falls on her abdomen, causing the death of her unborn child. Since assault requires a high threshold of substantial pain or loss of physical ability, it is possible that there could be only a misdemeanor crime of harassment. This is particularly plausible if the woman was intoxicated or taking pain medications. She would be unable to feel the pain. Or suppose that a man gets his girlfriend pregnant. She decides that she will carry the baby to term, but he, afraid of what this could mean to his lifestyle, slips her a substance, perhaps an herbal substance, that would harm her developing child and end her pregnancy. In the hypothetical case I just described, the man would have committed no crime. If he, and this is not in my written testimony, if he were to administer, say, RU486 to her without her permission, he would only have committed the crime of administering the prescription drug without the proper authority. In any of these examples, the question you must ask is, has the trauma that the mother-to-be has been put through been addressed adequately by the law? I think that you would agree that when she finds her immense sense of loss would be treated as irrelevant by the law, the system would victimize the woman yet again. There are, of course, hypothetical cases with varying likelihoods of coming to fruition, but they demonstrate my point that the alternative bills are inadequate to address these problems. Because in the name of political considerations and chicken little alarmism, they intentionally avoid the best solution, that of acknowledging that an unborn child has incredible value to the mother, and both should be protected under the law. As in the case of House Bill 2020, the protection of one of them protects the both of them. In regard to the testimony you've heard earlier today, please let me address some of the issues that were brought up. As to the issue of eliminating culpable mental states, I'm not an attorney, but this seems to be a highly fallacious argument. This bill gives the culpable mental state as knowingly for the new crime in Section 8. The remaining crimes of murder, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide all have culpable mental states in the statute already. In fact, that is how each is defined and made distinct from other criminal homicides, by the culpable mental state. And I find nothing which would remove them in the bill. And again, I'm not an attorney. I'll leave that up to the counsel and to the advice that you get. But to the argument that the person committing the crime should have to know that the woman is pregnant before a penalty is due is to ignore the legal principle of transferred intent, whereby the person meaning to do one thing unintentionally does another is still equally responsible for the consequences of his or her action. This is not a removal of the culpable mental state, no different than if a person shoots a gun in the air and the bullet comes down a mile away and kills a person. In this example, the shooter knowingly and recklessly discharged a gun in the air, and it's irrelevant that the shooter did not know that a person would be harmed. It doesn't matter who the bullet hits, a fetus or a mother or anybody. It's the fact that they did an act, and that is what the culpable mental state is based on. In earlier testimony, Representative Nolan gave three tests that all legislation should pass in order to be made into law. These are good tests, but I disagree on the conclusion that House Bill 2020 does not pass them, or the insinuation that Senate Bill 712 would. Admitting that an unborn child is a person worthy of protection is indeed the most efficient way of correcting the inequities in the law, rather than writing new statutes that add sentence enhancements to a few different crimes. Alternative bills, as proposed, are both cumbersome and inadequate, and in my opinion, do not fulfill the test that Representative Nolan outlined in her testimony. As to the argument that this would be chipping away at the so-called right to abortion, this too is a specious argument. If we look at our neighbor to the south, California's law was passed in 1971, 2 years before the Roe v. Wade decision. And despite this, California has more abortions than any other state and has had this law in place for 34 years. Abortion proponents have nothing to fear from this law. Only the violent or reckless do. The only thing that will change abortion law in this country is changing minds and hearts, not changing laws to protect the most vulnerable among us. I should add that, as you heard, some on the pro-life side do not like this bill, precisely because of its pro-choice stand, whereby it codifies an Oregon statute a right to abort previously given only through court decisions. This is not an abortion bill, and I'll repeat, it's not an abortion bill, but a common sense protection of both mother and child in their respective vulnerable states. As to Representative Ackerman's earlier question of fiscal impact, this is a valid concern, but it should be secondary to the demands of the safety of mothers and children. I think we'd all agree. But there is also an unquantifiable positive revenue outlook if we factor in the potential deterrence of reckless or violent behavior that would likely be the result of the publicity that will be associated with both the signing of the bill and its first test case. Perhaps the high profile of the Lacey Peterson case will shed some light on this potential in California that the legislative, fiscal, and revenue offices could attempt to quantify for you. There are some ways that the bill could be approved by amendment. For example, exemptions for lawful medical procedures and medical research, for example, stem cell research and fertility clinics, and perhaps an acts of the mother exception in Section 8, though the need for the latter is a debatable moral issue. In any case, I appreciate the committee taking up this matter. There are passionate arguments on both sides that make this a difficult issue to reach agreement on. But what I think we can all agree on is that this issue has become the elephant in the room, and it's time it was dealt with. I think that we should also all agree that a protection for the fetus and sentence enhancements for violence against pregnant women are not mutually exclusive, but rather could be complementary. And finally, I hope that we'll all agree that the law as written is woefully inadequate and does not address the obvious truth. What those of us know who have experienced even a miscarriage, either personally or in our circle of friends, and that is that to the pregnant woman, the wonder of pregnancy and the child she carries has incredible value. For the system to see that value as irrelevant victimizes the woman anew, and we should correct that problem the best way possible without regard to political concerns. I would just add, as to Representative Worth's comments as to how the bill could be changed, I would say perhaps look at House Bill 3501 from last session. And in that, it was patterned after the California law, which I will correct the earlier testimony, does in fact exempt what it says it calls the abortions under the Therapeutic Abortion Act. Otherwise, the bill, I believe, could possibly be unconstitutional under the current constitutional authority, because we can't make something illegal that the courts have construed as a constitutional right. So with that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Committee members, do you have any questions? Let you off easy, Mark. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who had not signed up that may want to testify? Okay, committee members and those of you in the audience, we do have some amendments coming. I think the public hearing has brought out a lot of things maybe that we hadn't all thought about. I know I've heard things I haven't thought about. And maybe we can put a group together. I know the speaker's interested in having your comments. If you do have some, take time to get them up, get them over to Mr. Taylor. And we'll be going back probably for some more hearing at a later time, but it'll be some time before the bill comes back. So we're adjourned for now. Thank you.